Welcome to the Locate 852 podcast, bringing you insights on how you can build and scale your business with social platforms. Hosted by the leading Facebook ad strategist in Hong Kong, entrepreneur, branding expert, and the founder of Locate 852, Chris Chung.
Dr. DeMartini, you have achieved so much in your life, from teaching in over 100 countries, reading over 30,000 books, and being a specialist in human behavior, only to name a few. There's so much that I want to unpack with you today for our audience to learn from. I know you have an incredible life story to share. So take us all the way back to the beginning. What was your upbringing like, and how were you as a child?
Okay. I was born in 1954, November 25th. So I'll be 67 here in a couple of weeks. I had, for some reason, an arm and leg turned in, kind of a deformity. I think probably because of the positioning when in the birth canal and also in gestation. So when I got about a year and a half old, I would fall over if I tried to stop, start to walk. So I started having to wear braces from 1.5 to 4 on my arm and leg. I also had to go to a speech pathologist because I wasn't able to use my mouth properly. And so I was, for about 3.5 years, I guess, 3 years or whatever, I had to do this work with my mouth exercises, and then I had to wear these braces. I got out of the braces and stopped doing that around 4. Then at 5, I ended up not quite fitting into the classes. They didn't know what to do with me in classes. I had to sit by myself in the classes because I wasn't wanting to draw with the boys, and they didn't want me to play with the girls. But I had Italian blood in me, and I like playing with, hanging out with the chicks. When I was in first grade, they were trying to teach me to read, and no matter what I did, it wasn't working. So I ain't going to normal reading to remedial reading to finally the dunce class. I had to wear a dunce cap. And the teacher finally had my parents come to school and says, "I'm afraid your son is never going to be able to read or write or communicate. Never mind mounting thing, never go very far in life." So the only way I made it through school was asking kids questions, which wasn't fluent, but enough to say, what did you get? What did you learn? By the time I was 12, I moved to a small town and I started to go to school there, and I started falling, really failing. At 13, I left home and I became a street kid. But I was good in sports. I was good at running by then, because once I got my feet straight, I wanted to run. I wanted to be out of my constraint. I've been on the run ever since, I guess. And I took up surfing, but Texas wasn't the surf capital where I was. California, Hawaii was. So at 14, I hitchhiked to California, down into Mexico, and 15, I made my way over to Hawaii. I first lived under a bridge, then I lived in a park bench, then in a bathroom, and then an abandoned car, finally a tent, and kept social climbing. Nearly died at 17 due to strychnine poisoning and on a surf while I was surfing. And that led me to a little health food store, which then led me to a yoga class where I met Paul Bragg, who is a teacher who one night, an hour, shared amazing information that inspired me and made me believe that maybe I could overcome my learning problems and someday learn how to read and become intelligent, because I assumed I was going to be a surfer. That was the only thing I was good at. And that started a journey to want to go and try to learn how to read, go back and take a GED, which is a high school equivalency test, because I never finished high school. And then to try to go back to school. At first I failed, and then I got really determined, and I decided I was going to not let anything stop me learning how to read and write properly and spell properly and speak properly. And slowly but surely, starting reading dictionaries with the help of my mom, memorizing 30 words a day, I grew my vocabulary, gained some sort of meaning, learned how to comprehend. And then from that day on, I never wanted to stop reading. I've been reading ever since. I've been writing ever since. I've been speaking ever since. And here I am 49 years later. I've now spoken in 155 countries. I've reached billions of people and written lots of stuff. I mean, hundreds of books and thousands of articles. So it goes to show you that when somebody says you can't do something, that may be the gift of your life. It may have been the very thing you end up doing. In my case, it happened that way. Yeah, go ahead.
You just mentioned Paul Bragg, which I definitely want to touch upon as well. How did Paul Bragg influence you to become who you are today? And what would you say are the kind of like the top three things that you learned from him?
Well, I learned a lot from him, but he said that we have a body, we have a mind, and we have a soul. And the body must be directed by the mind, and mind must be directed by the soul to maximize awareness and potential. He said that what we say to ourselves, what we think about ourselves, how we feel about ourselves, what we see for ourselves, the actions we take for ourselves make a difference. And if you don't command those and take command of what that is, and decide how those are going to be. Other people will decide, and no one's dedicated to fulfilling your life except you. And then you said you want to set goals for yourself, your family, your community, your city, your state, your nation, and world for 100 to 120 years. And what happened is I just decided this is sensible, what he's saying, and I'm going to master this thing. And I started out on a journey to try to overcome my learning problems. But he inspired me quite extensively, changed my viewpoint by what he said, my eating and thinking and living lifestyle points. And I went on to want to be a scholar. And today I'm blessed to, I get blessed. I do seminars and presentations and podcasts and webinars every single day, 7 days a week, every day.
And what would you say is the significance of I'm a genius and I'm applying my wisdom?
Well, he gave me that affirmation. When he finished talking that night, he said that he was going to be doing classes every morning at Fort Narussi on the Waikiki Beach area, which is the opposite side of the island. So at 5 something in the morning, I got up and hitchhiked into the other side of the island so I could be with him. And for 3 weeks, I studied with him and learned a lot, mainly about health and mind and state of mind and things. And then one day when he said, I'm going off to California, I hope to see you all again. I don't know when I'll be back. There was a part of me that's like, oh, and as long as he was there, I felt encouraged to move forward. If he's not there, I'm like going, oh, what's going to happen now? And so I never had the courage to walk to him because he's a little bit more animated than I was prepared for. But that day I walked up to him and I said, after everybody left, I was the only one left. And I was the only one young. Everybody else was 50, 60, 70, 80 years old. And he said, I walked up to him and I said, you know, sir, I was at your class 3 weeks ago. And you said that whatever we decided that night would be our destiny. He said, well, that's right, son. I said, well, what I saw is I was going to be a teacher and I was going to learn. And frankly, I don't know how to read. I don't know how to write. I got speaking problems. He looked at me with utmost certainty and he says, that's not a problem, young man. Is there any other problems? I said, no, sir. And he said, then what you want to do is you want to say to yourself every single day that I am a genius and I apply my wisdom. And he made me say it about 5 times until my eyes closed and I could see it in my mind's eye. He said, now say that every single day, don't miss a day. And sooner or later, the cells of your body will tingle with it. And so will the world. So I started saying that. And to this day, I've never missed a day, that statement. I later asked my mom, what exactly is a genius? She said, well, people like Albert Einstein and Da Vinci. And I said, oh, but I redefined the definition of a genius as one who listens to the inner voice and follows the inner vision and lets the voice and the vision on the inside be louder than all opinions on the outside. And that wakes up nice genius. But I've been focusing on learning and sharing and inspiring and doing what I can to assist other people in doing something, whatever it is, extraordinary with their life. And I don't have anything I'd rather be doing. That's the thing that I love doing. I spontaneously do it. I do it every day. And you're letting me do it right now. So I get the opportunity to do it right now.
There's a lot of split views on affirmations. Some people believe that it's life-changing. Others think it's similar on betting on luck. I know that you personally have 24 affirmations for each hour of the day. That's 26 pages long. What is your experience with daily affirmations besides I'm a genius and I apply my wisdom? And how has that impacted your life?
Well, there are both of those statements and beliefs about affirmations are true. The word affirmation means a condition of firmness in one's mind, but kind of the New Age movement tried to make it positive thinking. If you set up a fantasy like I'm always happy, I'm never sad, your BS meter is going to go off and your intuition is going to go, that's BS. And it's not going to do anything except make you bipolar kind of. But if you say, whether I'm supported or challenged, I see both of them as feedback mechanisms towards my authentic self, and I'm grateful. Now what you're doing is you're creating a checkup from the neck up, and you're making a statement about how to perceive life and how to act upon life in a way that is solid and objective. And those statements are nothing more than things to feed your mind with, to, you know, principles to live your life by. So I am certain that that can make a difference. I've done that for many, many years, and I've seen the outcome of that. I'm living what those statements have led to. But I had to polish and refine a lot of statements that were fantasies initially. And it's the fantasy statements that give no results except frustration. To say that I'm always one thing, whenever the other way, when we live in a two-sided world, is delusional. So just making statements up that aren't really grounded are unproductive and misleading and definitely defeating. But making a statement that's truly congruent with what you value most, that is objective, that you have a strategy to fulfill, and it's deeply meaningful, and it's aligned with what you value most, and you're willing to do the actions that it takes to do it, is a way of being a checkup from the neck up to take you towards your objective in life. So I had to learn how to clean up those statements over the years and make sure they were true objectives that really were demonstrated important to me, that I was willing to do whatever it takes to achieve. And then it's a reminder of what that achievement's going to look like with foresight.
So what made you go from the first few affirmations to now build up at least 24 or more than that over time?
I think it's more like 24,000. I have enough affirmations to keep me busy for, I'm certain that I have probably one of the largest list of internal dialogues because I learned that if you don't plant flowers in the garden of your mind, you're going to pull weeds. Mm. If you don't fill your day with high priority actions that inspire you, your day's going to fill up with low priority distractions that don't. So you might as well define how you want your life and concentrate on it and not be at the whim of everybody else's expectation. Many people don't know the difference between a fantasy and a real objective, but if they set a real objective, they get a real result. So I don't mind stating things that are clear. I mean, I have way longer than 24. I could show you, if I pulled up a file, I could show you thousands of them, literally pages of them. And every book I've written have them. And they're all over the place. They're in every section of my master plan book. And it's just loaded. And every manuscript I write, they're filled with it. I just finished a program that I just presented the other day that's 5 days long. It's 14 hours a day. It's on 200 of the greatest minds and philosophers who ever lived that contributed to the world. People like Socrates and Plato and, you know, Epictetus and Pythagoras and Spinoza and, you know, Schweitzer and these kind of people. And what I did is I took the most significant essence extracted from their writings, quotations and principles, and I put together 19,000 of those statements in just one text that's 1,300 pages. So there's a lot of quotations in there. So I've written, you know, I would say easily 100,000 quotations that I've got stored somewhere.
I love the story that you briefly mentioned just now. Can you share with us how the story of you learning 30 words a day and the role that your mom played?
Well, what happened is when I was 18 years old, I took my GED, I guessed and passed. I tried to go back to school to try to go on to a junior college. And I tried to take two classes, English and history. And I thought because I had guessed and passed the GED test just by guessing that it was going to be the same for these other classes. But when I got the test scores the following day, I got a 27 and I needed a 72 to pass. That was failing. 72 or less was failing. I got a 27. So when I saw that score, I was very defeated, distraught, ran to my car, cried in my car, drove home with tears in my eyes and having a real moment thinking, well, maybe this idea is an illusion. I can't even pass a test. I can't. This is just an illusion. I fooled myself. And I went home, went inside the living room, curled up in a fetal position under a Bible stand and on a sunken living room. I was really having a low moment just thinking, well, I guess I'm going back to surfing. I guess this is not going to work. Really felt defeated. And my mom came home from shopping and she saw me there and said, son, what happened? What's wrong? She didn't see me cry since I was long because I left home at 13. And so she said, what happened, son? I said, I blew the test. And I repeated what my first grade teacher said. I guess I'll never be able to read or write or be able to communicate, never amount to thing, never go very far in life. And she just paused for a second and said a really brilliant thing. She put her hand on my shoulder and she said, son, whether you become a great teacher, healer, philosopher, and travel the world like you say you want to do and dream, whether you go back to Hawaii and ride giant waves, which you've done, because I used to ride big waves, or you return to the streets and panhandle as a bum on the streets, which I also did as a teenager. I was a street kid. She says, I just want to let you know that we're going to love you no matter what, your dad and I. Well, when she said that, it brought tears to my eyes. My hand went into a fist, and I said to myself with a determination of no turning back, I said, I'm going to master the single reading, studying, and learning. I'm going to master the single teaching, healing, and philosophy, and I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to travel whatever distance, I'm going to pay whatever price to give my service of love across this planet. I'm not going to let any human being on the face of this earth stop me now, not even myself. And I got up and I hugged my mom. I went into my room and there was a Funk and Wagnalls dictionary there. Every time you went to Kroger supermarket, you bought $20 worth of food, you get another volume of an encyclopedia as a gift. So my mom used to send me to go get all the encyclopedia volumes and gave me, you know, 20, 25 bucks to go buy groceries. So I could get that extra volume. Well, one of the volumes was a dictionary. And so I went into that dictionary, I pulled it out. It's covered in tape today. It's fallen apart because I've used it so much. And I made a commitment that I was going to memorize the dictionary and do 30 words a day and grow my vocabulary 30 words a day. So I would read the words, I would spell the words, I would pronounce the words, I would write out the spelling sometimes 20 to 50 times. I would make sure I could spell it properly with my mouth and pronounce it right. I looked at the meaning and I made sure I really grasped what that meant. And then I had to use it in a sentence. And then my mom would test me on 30 words a day to make sure I really did that. And if I didn't get all 30 of them, I had to start over and stay stay there until I got it done. Couldn't go to bed until I'd done. And I grew my vocabulary 30 words a day. I started reading that in other dictionaries and the encyclopedias. And any word in the encyclopedia that I didn't know, I had the dictionary and I added it to my list. And I just kept growing my vocabulary and expanding my information. I later went on over the next couple of years, reading 8 complete sets of the 24, 25 volume, 26 volume encyclopedia sets, just so I could expand my awareness to try to catch up with all the other kids that were ahead of me. And I'm so grateful because my vocabulary grew, my depth of information grew. And I was, in a very short period of time, from the bottom of the class to the very top, I was just amazed how fast, if you really, time times intensity gives result. If you intensify your efforts towards some objective in a short period of time, you can do amazing things. Mm-hmm. And then I started asking every single day what worked, what didn't work, and how can I do it more effectively and efficiently tomorrow? And that taught me eventually how to speed read, how to photograph, how to expand my awareness. And that allowed me to eventually excel up to one day I read 11,000 pages and still had that in preparation for an oncology presentation I was giving to 1,000 oncologists. So I'm amazed at what our capacity is if we really have a clear intention and there's no turning back. So that was a turning point in my life of determination when my mom said what she said. That had a massive impact on my life.
Beautiful. You previously also shared in other interviews that there was a pivotal moment that changed your perception towards money. What were the 10 questions that changed your perception on money, and how does that tie into forced accelerated saving?
Well, those are great questions. You've obviously done your homework. A gentleman came into my office in 1982. I was 27 years old. I just finished my professional schooling and I'd opened up a practice. I can't say that I was financially literate. I had a fantasy that somehow I would be prosperous, but I had no real idea what was going on with money. But this guy walked in, I guess he was just a financial planner that was looking for business, saw a doctor there, thought might be a good client, came in and asked me some questions, asked if he could speak with me. I figured I got something to learn. I can't lose on it. But he asked me some questions that really knocked the socks out of me. The first question he asked me was, and these are the 10 questions, if you don't know the answers to them, you're really saying I'm not intending to be financially independent. And financial independent is where your passive income is exceeding any active income and you're self-sufficient. So he asked me, what is my current total net worth? And I wasn't even sure what it was. And I pretended like I did. So I asked him, well, what do you mean by that? What it really meant is I didn't know. But I was embarrassed. So I said, what do you mean exactly by that? And he says, your current net worth. What are all your assets? Your current asset base. Give me some samples of what you mean by assets. I said, because I felt humiliated. I was so stupid about it. And he said, well, like stocks, like rental properties, like cash, equity in homes, none of those I had. So I said, I'd have to think it through. He says, okay, I've got a minute. Go ahead and think it through. Anyway, when I looked at it, it wasn't anything. It was more debt than it was asset. And I had really nothing. I mean, I had some books and I had debts. Anyway, when I looked at it, I said, I really don't have anything. It's negative. He says, okay, then we just got to be clear. Because if you don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going and you get an Uber, they don't know where to take you. And when it comes to finance, if you don't know where you are and where you're going and you don't have a strategy, it's not going to happen. So I just need to know where you are. Then he said, what's your current liabilities, total liabilities? That I was more aware of. I was more knowledgeable about my liabilities because I knew I had this, you know, outstanding debt and this loan and this loan and this thing. And so I was able to decide what that was. And when I added them up, I was in debt. I was in, you know, 100,000 plus in debt. So then I totaled all that. And he says, now that we've got your assets and liabilities, what's your total net worth? And it was negative. I owed people money. I didn't have any assets. And he goes, okay, at least we now know where you are. If you don't know where you are, you're saying it's not important to me. Because people that don't know where they are and don't know where they're going, don't have a strategy, they're really saying, I have no intention of being financially independent. Number four, he said, how much money would you love to have passively annually as an income off your investments? So you're not having to work, but you get the lifestyle you want without having to work. And I said, $100,000. And this is 1982, which today would be probably worth $600,000. And that seemed like a decent amount of money at the time. And that was more than I ever made, really. That's about as much as I ever made in 1 year. But anyway, he said, okay, $100,000. And he's writing this down. And he said, what is the current interest rate that you feel you can earn with your knowledge of investing? I had no idea. I knew the banks, we were a high inflation rate at the time. And I knew the banks were offering like 6-7%. So I said, 7%, 8%. He said, okay, 8%. What's the average inflation rate you're going to be facing increasing in your life during the time you're going to accumulate your wealth. I had no idea. He said, let's put down 3% then. And we wrote down 3%. And I said, now, what is the total net worth that you need right now to earn you $100,000 a year at 8% minus 5%, minus 3%, which is averaging 5%? I said, I have no idea. I have to calculate that. Well, okay, let's calculate. And we came up with $2 million times 5%, which is 8 minus 3. So if you take 100,000 times 5% into 100% is 20. 20 times 100,000 is 2 million. So I said, okay, I need $2 million. But I had a negative net worth. So I said, so what's the shortfall? He asked me, what's the shortfall between what you need and what you have? And I said, well, it's 2.1. I said, well, I need right now $2.1 million today in order to be financially independent. And I just immediately got a headache and nausea and stomach aches and everything else because I'm thinking, how in the hell am I going to do that? And he says, so the next question is, because that was 8. Number 9 is, what's the strategy now that you're going to do to get that? I said, I have no idea. He said, well, you have to come up with a strategy because if you don't have any idea, if you didn't know where you are, you don't know where you're going, and you have no strategy, it ain't going to happen, buddy. He's trying to basically show that he was needed in my life and he was doing a pretty good job. And we sat down and I said, I have no strategy. I have no idea. And I calculated that I needed $2.1 million. So I thought, well, I need $2.1 million in the next 24 hours. And I thought, is there any way of doing that? I don't know of any way. I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel on that one. Okay, I need $550,000 over the next 2 days. 550. Couldn't see that one. 250 times 25, 250, 25 on 4 days. Couldn't see that. 125, 12, so that's 167 or whatever, plus 50 cents times 8 days or whatever it was. And I was going blank. No matter what I did, now how far I stretched it out, it seemed all overwhelming. And I eventually stretched it out over like 15 years. But then I had to factor inflation in because then I would need $4,200,000 by then. So then I thought, okay, I got 15 years to get $4.2 million. How much is that on average per year? Calculated out to 180 months, 180 into 4 million is 22,000 or so a month I need to be saving. And at the time I was saving $1 an hour, $10 a day, $50 a week, $200 a month. And I needed 20,000. So that means I needed 200 a month to 20,000 a month, which is a vast difference. That's like 100 times fold. And I just said, I couldn't even imagine saving $20,000 a month at that time, $22,000. I didn't see any possible way with my mentality at the time. Because that's one line, I didn't know how to make that amount of money, gross. And I certainly didn't know how to make that after taxes and put it in savings. And I got to live on something. It was just outside my realm of thinking at the time. And I sat there and I had a headache and I was stressed. And he just patiently waiting because he knew what was going down. And then all of a sudden, something popped in my mind, a way of doing it. Because once I started thinking in terms of 15 years, I thought, you know what? I can start out at $200 a month, but I'm sure that I will learn something more along the way to be able to increase that. And I can always increase it and move closer to what it's needed and maybe even surpass it someday. So I created what is called a force accelerated savings and a force accelerated investment technique, fast and fate. And I decided I was going to save $200 a month for 3 months. At the end of 3 months, I was going to make it $300. At the end of 3 months, I was going to make it $500. At the end of 3 months, I was going to make it $750. At the end of 3 months, I was going to make it $1,000. And every 3 months, once I got comfortable for 90 days on what I was doing, I was going to increase it. Because I figured I got nothing to lose by saving because I have the money to pay the bills. That's in my hands. It's not like it's thrown away or burnt. But when I started to manage money wisely, I started to receive more money. More business started coming in. So when I started to save that, I didn't miss it. And I started saving more, I didn't miss it. I got more business. And when I hit $1,000 a month, I ran a projection. And I went, you know what? I could be a millionaire in 34 years. But then I thought, I'm not going to stop here. I'm going to increase it 10% every quarter. 10% increase, a Pascal triangle increase, a binomial number. So I made it 1,100 for 3 months, and 1,210 for 3 months, and 1,344 for 3 months, and 560 or whatever, 4466 for 3 months. And every 2 years it doubled. And in the meantime, I'm paying off debt, but I'm increasing my savings. And then some of those debts came finished. And I took what I was paying for that into it and I increased it. And then I kept increasing it by 10%. And it got to be 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 16,000, 32,000, 64,000. Every 2 years it was doubling. And all of a sudden, 9 years after I started, I had reached with inflation the equivalent of my original financial independence. But I didn't stop there. Instead of raising my lifestyle, I just kept raising my investments. and kept the lifestyle moderate and just kept raising the investments and running a projection. And the first million that I got, and the second million was easier, and the third million was easier. Now I've made a million in a day. But at the time it was 34 years originally. But now it's cranking out a million because of compound interest, the great eighth wonder of the world. But what's interesting is the amount that it's I started with, it was by the inch, it's a cinch. And I let little piggy banks become piggy banks. And I let compound interest work on my behavior. And I let the nature of investing a little bit more every time draw more opportunities and businesses. And I tell people, if you'll do this, it will blow your mind. When you manage money wisely, you get more money to manage. And every person that's I've initiated this on has thanked me. It's not rocket science. It's just, if you're waiting for the money to come, you'll wait for eternity. You've got to make sure that you create the demand on yourself and you'll get the supply to yourself. The way the universe is waiting for you to value yourself. That's the lesson to know.
I want to ask you a quick question on the mentor versus mentee relationship. How significant is it to have aligned values between a mentor and a mentee to success? And how should people find and achieve alignment?
Well, in the 1980s, I was doing quite a bit of consulting for doctors. I had grown my practice significantly in a very short period of time because of what I was just telling you, other priorities and delegating. And I found that there was a lot of consulting firms that asked me to speak on their conferences as a guest speaker. And I was watching some people, you know, pick that consulting company and come. And I saw some that just flourished. And I saw others that didn't get off the ground. And I was curious, why is it that these people are doing the same thing or trying to do the same? They just can't do it. It's just not their nature. And then I would see sometimes a year later, that same individual with another consultant is a different set of priorities, different way of approaching it. And now they're flourishing. And I scratch my head and go, why is it that this guy was not doing well here and now he's doing well here? Something about the information. And I was accessed. I got access to all the information, all these consulting firms. They gave it to me as a gift. And I looked and the information wasn't drastically different. What was different is the values of the leader of that company and the principles that they were displaying were more in line with the individual, and then they take off. Because otherwise they got internal conflict and they're trying to be somebody they're not. And people can feel that. And nature rewards authenticity. So yeah, I think whatever your hierarchy of values is dictating your destiny. And if you go with a consulting or try to do something that's not congruent with what your values are, you're going to have internal conflicts and you're going to have a tendency to procrastinate, hesitate, and frustrate instead of being inspired by some. So yeah, I think it's very crucial to make sure that whoever you're learning from, mentoring from, getting consulting from, that the models and principles and values that they hold are, they don't have to be the same, but they have to not be massively conflicting. Mm. That's all.
How common is it for you to find people that are either unhappy or unsuccessful because they're living through other people's values, but thinking it's their own?
Most people, the majority of people, in some degree or another. Most people let the herd instinct and impulse and the collective consciousness influence them. They become borrowed visionaries instead of unborrowed visionaries, and they subordinate to outer authorities, their mothers, their fathers, their preachers, their teachers, their conventions, their traditions, their mores, and they don't give themselves permission to shine as an independent, authentic individual. And anybody that you put above you that you're too humble to admit that you have what they have, you're going to inject their values, which is going to cloud the clarity of your own direction and your own highest values. And that is where most people end up having self-defeat. Because anytime you minimize yourself to somebody else and try to be second at being them and trying to live and envy them and imitate them, you're guaranteed to minimize you. You know, I'm me. I'm not somebody else. I have no desire to be somebody else. I was asked by Vogue magazine a number of years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago now. Vogue magazine interviewed me and they had 17 questions. The very last question was an interesting one. Dr. DeMartini, if there's anybody you could be in the world, who would you want to be? And I thought, what a ridiculous question. I said, I have no desire to be anybody. Why would I want to be anybody but Dr. John DeMartini? That doesn't make any sense. I want to be the greatest me, not be somebody other than me. And they go, oh, well, most people answer that. That's interesting. So you don't have somebody you wish you could be like? And I go, no. I'd rather be 100% me than some other percentage of somebody else. And they were puzzled by that because that's not what they usually do. People say, oh, I'd like to be like so-and-so or like, I wish I could have that life. I don't have a desire to be somebody else or live somebody else's life. I live an amazing life. I've worked for it. I do extraordinary things. I get to meet amazing people. I get an amazing life because I followed the path that was more authentic to me and that led me to those outcomes. And so I tell people, envy is ignorance and imitation is suicide, as Ralph Waldo Emerson used to say. And we're not here to be second at being somebody else. We're here to be first at being us.
I know that you've developed a test with 80 questions, but can you please share with us a few that you think are the most important questions And the internal dialogue you kind of use in order to make sure your state is in equilibrium?
Well, there's a series of questions to help first define what it is that you value and what's important to you. That's my value determination process. There's 13 of those questions. And then there's the DeMartini method, which is a method of dissolving apparent chaos that you may be perceiving in your life that's holding you back from seeing the hidden order and what's actually occurring. And there's some questions there. For instance, let's say you meet somebody and they've done something that you've resented or disliked. You immediately ask, okay, so what individual do you perceive displaying or demonstrating some specific trait, action, or inaction that you despise most? Well, this guy over here. Great. Now, next question is, what specific trait, action, or inaction do you perceive that individual displaying or demonstrating that you dislike or despise or hate most? And you write it down. And it's got to be specific. It can't be vague generalities like, well, mean. It can't be labels. It can't be abusive because no one knows what that is. If I said they abuse me, what did they do? It doesn't tell you what they did. But if I said that they specifically criticize me in front of my friends, then it's specific. So I define what it is that I'm judging, because judgments are very specific in moments of time and space. Once I've identified that, I look at, make sure that I can see what that trait is and it's clear. It can't be any hearsay. It can't be vague generalities. It can't be synonyms if it's more than one. It can't be how you felt, because it's not what they did. It's what you felt after what they did. I want to know what they did that you judged. And then the next question you ask is, okay, John, talk to myself now. John, go to a moment where and when you perceive yourself displaying or demonstrating that same or similar specific trait, action, or inaction that you despise most. And I go look at where I've done it. And our natural tendency is to be too proud to admit what we see in others inside us and to avoid it and pretend like it's not there and inside us. And that's foolishness, because we do not resent things on the outside unless they're reminding us of something in our inside that we're feeling ashamed about and not wanting to admit. So then we go in there and find out where it was. So John, go to a moment where and when you perceive yourself displaying or demonstrating the same specific trait, action, and action that you despise most. Great. Where was it? When was it? Who did you demonstrate it to, and who perceived you that way? And then go the next moment you did it. Where was it? When was it? Who'd you do it to, and who perceived you that doing it that way? Then go the next moment, and you keep stacking up moments, looking honestly in your life. And there's plenty of moments in your life if you look, because you're not going to judge something that's something you haven't done. I guarantee it. I've been doing it for 36 years. And go in there and identify where it is until the quantity of you doing it and the quality of you doing it is equal to what you saw in them. And most people go, well, no, that's not true. I've never done that. I don't do that. I got 36 years, hundreds of thousands of people to prove you're wrong. So you're not willing to look. You don't want to actually face the truth. You may have made it unconscious. You may have blocked your memory of it to make you feel better about yourself. But the truth is, you do not judge something in other people you don't have. And people go, well, I don't believe that. And I go, I've proven that, and I have won every time. So I basically tell them, go look at it where it is until it's owned. And the moment they own it, all of a sudden they realize, well, my fingers are pointing back at me more than them. Who am I to be judging them? And that starts to calm the judgment. Then you go to the next question. All right, John, go to a moment where and when you perceive this individual displaying or demonstrating that trait, that action or inaction that you despise most. You there? Great. In that moment, go to that moment. Okay, you there? Where are you? When are you? And in that moment, at that moment you perceived it, what was the benefit to you? How did it serve you at that moment? Well, it didn't. It's a bad thing. No, all events are neutral until somebody with a subjective bias and a narrow mind label it as something good or bad. How did it benefit you? Because we've all had situations where we had something that we thought was terrible in a day, a week, a month, a year, 5 years later. Oh, thank God that occurred. So why have the wisdom of the ages with the aging process? You can have the wisdom of the ages without it. Look now. So I make them look and hold them accountable to look and stack up the advantages. How did it benefit you? How did it help you spiritually? How did it help you mentally? How did it help you in your career? How did it help you in your finance, your family, your social, your physical? How did it help you fulfill what you feel is your purpose in life? And I make them hold it and still dig until all of a sudden the benefits equal the drawbacks. And all of a sudden their resentment's gone. And they're all going, well, there's nothing there to even be angry about. It's neither positive nor negative. There's just as many advantages and disadvantages. So why judge it in the first place? And I do it to the same degree as them. So why am I judging them? And it kind of stops the judgment. Then you can go the next step. Go to the moment where and when you did it, to who you did it to, and how did it benefit them? Because you may be sitting there storing shame over the past. And as long as you do, people are going to remind you of it. And the reason you're angry and resentful to them is you're reminding you of what you feel guilty inside. So if you go and find out how it serves other people, and don't make it up, don't speculate, but look, I guarantee you there's a benefit. Once you look, you liberate the shame, and now you liberate the resentment in what they did. And you're starting to think, you know what? This person came into my life to guide me to be more authentic, more empowered, more balanced, help me heal. Then you go a step further and go, okay, now go to a moment where and when you perceive this individual displaying or demonstrating the trait you despise most. You there? Great. Who did they do it to? Well, me. Great. Now, go to a moment where that same individual displayed the opposite to you. If they verbally criticize you, where do they verbally praise you? Or where do they do the opposite behavior to you? And if you look, it'll mind-blowingly wake you up and realize that there's times when they did the opposite behavior. And when you do and you balance that out, you realize the labels you had on them were just not even true. They were exaggerated biases because of your own wounds. And then you go a step further and you go to the moment where and when you perceive them displaying or demonstrating the trait. You there? Great. Where are you? When are you? What's the content specifically? What's the context? And who are they doing it to? And at that exact moment, who is doing it opposite to whoever they're doing it to? So if they're verbally criticizing you, who's praising you at that moment? It could be a real person or a virtual person in your mind. It could be one or many. It could be male or female. It could be close or distant. It could be real or virtual. And go find out where that is. And you'll find out that there's always a pair of opposites because you cannot perceive one-sided events. There's always two sides to every event. In other words, if you infatuate with somebody, you're comparing them to somebody you resent. And if you're resentful to somebody, you're comparing to something you're infatuated with. There's no nightmare without a fantasy. There's no depression without an elation. There's always a pair of opposites. And once you see it, you'll realize that your addiction to the opposite is what drew that into your life to balance you, to help liberate you, to set you free from your judgments and your wounds. And then if you go one step further, this is the fun one. Now go to a moment where and when they displayed it. You're there. And in that moment, if they had done what you hoped they would have done and been the way you wished they would have been, what would have been the drawback? Because as long as you're comparing what they did to a fantasy about how they should have been, would have been, could have been, you're not going to appreciate what they are. Because nobody can appreciate the now without, while you're comparing it to some fantasy that doesn't exist. Because anything other than what they did is not something that existed. It's something you fabricated in your mind. So you go in there and you ask at that moment, whenever they did it, if they'd done the opposite, what would have been the drawback? And you find the drawbacks of the fantasy you're comparing them to. And all of a sudden you feel a tremendous gratitude for this individual being in your life. And you realize that this thing had nothing to do with them. It had everything to do with your misperceptions of them. So those are 7 questions of about 80 questions that if you keep doing that, all you're going to be left with is absolute recognition of a hidden order in your parent chaos, an appreciation for the magnificence of life. You're going to actually realize that there's nothing there to fix, nothing to change, just something to be grateful for. And now you've got baggage dissolved and fuel emerged. So that's just 7 of the 80 questions.
Beautiful. Why is it that if we don't fill our day with order, that it fills up with disorder?
One of the principles that Clausius, Boltzmann, and many people, Einstein, a lot of people worked on it, Leibniz, is that nature has a tendency to go from order to disorder. You know, if you put something on an apple, it's eventually going to deteriorate. It's not going to get more organized. It's going to get more disorganized over time. So nature have a tendency, unless something is alive and it's growing, it tends to go in the opposite direction. Only living organisms are negentropic and go towards order. Everything else goes to entropy. So if you don't fill your day with high priority actions that bring you into order, and you don't fill your brain with high priority internal dialogues and high priority perceptions and questions that bring order to your perceptions, your life is going to fill up with chaos. And the chaos, the symptoms of the chaos are gifts. They're letting you know that you're not seeing life through wise eyes, and is trying to create symptoms in your life to try to wake you up to what's inauthentic to help you become authentic. So I'm a firm believer in asking the quality questions to make you conscious of what has been unconscious, so you can be fully conscious and mindful and ordered. And there is a hidden order in our apparent chaos if you ask the right question.
My last question is, if you were to be stripped away from all of your money, resources, and network today, and you have to start all over again, what are the first 3 things you would do and why?
Well, if I gave up all the assets and returned to a tent, there's one thing they can never take away from you, really, or 2 things, and that's your love and wisdom. And as long as I've got love and I've got wisdom, I could rebuild anything because I've got something to be of contribution to other people about. Everybody wants to be loved and appreciated for who they are, and everybody wants the wisdom of how to live a more fulfilled life. So if you took it away, I'd start rebuilding it again. I'd just go out and find a way of being of service to people. And I started out living under, speaking under trees in parks, and I'd just start again. I would have all that knowledge. I have all the knowledge that I now know, so I would know how to do it much quicker. The first, to be where I am today financially, took me a lot longer than what I bet it would happen on the second one, because I know exactly how to do it now. So I would rebuild it and, you know, not, be like, okay, it's not something I probably prefer to experience. I'd prefer not to have to go and do that. But at the same time, I feel certain that as long as I've got my love and wisdom, I could go and rebuild everything that I've done in a much shorter period of time.
Dr. Demartini, I appreciate you being on the show. For the people people that want to follow you and keep up with what you do, where is the best place to find you?
They can simply go to drdemartini.com, drdemartini.com, drdemartini.com. There's a value determination process that's a free complimentary private value determination process to help you determine what's really important to you, which is a goal mine to do if you haven't taken the time to do it. There is research materials on there. There's writings, there's articles, there's TV, radio, newspapers, podcasts, webinars. There's a plethora of information. You could keep yourself busy for the rest of your life, and I guarantee I'll put more on there than what you can ever get all through. I got enough on there. You're going to have to be a Buddhist believing in multiple reincarnations and metapsychosis to be able to deal with all the stuff that's on there. And just come and take advantage of the website. It's filled with great information that is practical information you can use in your daily life.
Dr. DeMartini, thank you for being on the show. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. Thank you for the opportunity to be with your audience. Thank you.